My name is Pete Doyle. I'm 55 years old. Today is the 3rd of September in 2007. We're in my hometown of Baltimore, and I'm speaking to my partner Jim Baker here. We're students together. I've worked with him. We've been a colleague for 27 years or so.
My name's Jim Baker. I'm 79 years old. Today's date is the 3rd of October. I'm in Baltimore, the correct pronunciation for it. And Pete has already told you, I think, our relationship, how we knew each other.
Okay, and Jim was correct. It is September, not October. Memory starts to fail.
October?
Oh, October, right.
How the time flies.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you work in a field called human factors and ergonomics. In fact, you were one of the ones involved in the field's infancy in the late 50s. Tell us what the discipline of human factors is about and how it was that you got started in it.
The thing it's about most of all is just designing systems so that they can be used by people. And that's where we come up with terms like user-centered design. It's not always practice, but it's there. My own start came from I was in graduate school under Professor John C. Townsend, and got recalled for the Korean War, and John had left. I was his first graduate student. I was working on a master's. I came back. He was gone. I went to Ohio State, met my wife, got married. My GI Bill had run out, and so I needed a job, needed one fast, so I contacted John, who was now the director of the Fighter Intercept School at Tyndall Air Force Base, and John said, tell you what, call your friend Jack Huffner in Boston, actually out in Bedford. He said they're opening a whole new operation on a thing they call SAGE, and if you know anything about programming computers, you're in. I said, piece of cake. So I called up there, and I had been working in the aviation lab, some stuff for Paul Fitz. I had learned how to program an analog computer. I knew nothing about a digital computer. Nobody else did, because the system we were working on was the first digital computer system, and it turns out that I figured a smart fellow like me could figure out how to get from analog to digital easy enough, and that's essentially how I got into it. The group I was with, just as an aside, was the Air Force Personnel Training and Research Center. It was headquartered in San Antonio, Texas, but we were a field unit. It was, at that time, the largest gathering of psychologists in the world. It was headed by Arthur Melton, and his assistant was Chuck Bray of the Weaver Bray Cochlear Microphonics fame. So at any rate, that's how I got into it, and I have no regrets with that. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Well, perhaps you have some memorable stories about the early days in the profession.
Yeah, let's see. Got two kinds of memorable stories. One is that has to do, and I'll make a short one of this. In 1978, the meeting was being held, the human factors meeting was being held in Dallas, Texas. When we got there, we found out that the Congress had redlined the entire human factors budget. There was a great human factors guy named Smoke Price, and Dean Haverin and I got together and said, we got to do something about this. So we went to see the first woman president of Human Factors Society, Gloria Grace. Said, Gloria, we live in Washington. We're willing to go up in the hill and fight this for the society. We said, we need a letter from you. She said, let me check with the legal biggles. I'll send you the letter, and she did. And so Smoke and Dean and I went up on the hill, and managed to give a presentation before the Congressional Armed Services Committee, the Senate Armed Service Committee, and finally we were taken in to see Senator Stennis, who was the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Now, Stennis was from Mississippi and had this phenomenal draw. Dean Havrin started the discussion with a drawl I had never heard before. I had asked him later, he said, I once went to school in Tennessee. And these two good old boys went back and forth. And they presented, he said, tell me why I shouldn't redline this. Smoke mentioned the one study that he had been involved in for carrier landings and how to change the paddles to a red ball. And Stennis said, how much would that save? And he said, oh, about 16 aircraft accidents per year. He asked his aide, what's that amount to? And the guy said, multi-million dollars. And he said, we're redlining a $5 or $6 million item out of the budget. Put it back in for these boys. And he got it restored. The thing that resulted from that was Human Factors suddenly realized you had to get political, and they formed a group called the Human Factors Public Relations Committee, which now I think is called the Outreach Committee or something like that, Outreach Advisory Committee.
Very good. You know, I suspect that you've been in this field for many decades now, and that over the time, perhaps you've seen some of the same challenges come up again and again. For some reason, some of the challenges never seem to be put to bed once and for all. Do you have any suggestions for addressing this kind of approach? Why do we have to keep learning the same lessons in some instances?
Yeah, it's what I call Baker's two-decade law. What it amounts to is I learned about it when I was doing work in the military and when I was in the service and doing work in the military as well. The normal tour for somebody in the military is about 20 years. And what happens is that the young officers who come in that are eventually going to be the senior officers and the generals are so busy learning their job that all the problems that have been solved by the colonels and by the generals, they haven't become aware of. Now, when they're senior officers, the problem looks brand new because the others have retired. So every 20 years, they've rediscovered the same problem and reinvent the wheel. I thought it was unique to the military, but I'm finding that's true everywhere, in politics, in industry, everywhere I go. Every 20 years, people will have to go back and figure out what went wrong before and how do I correct it this time. What it resulted in, I'll give you an example. And when I was first starting on this in the mid-50s, we developed a thing called the PSS, Personnel Subsystems, for the SAGE system I was working on. When I went, the Navy found out about it and did a thing called hard mail. When I went with the Army, I took the exact same things I knew, and we changed it to manprint. The Air Force, the 20 years was up, and they had invented the PSS. It happened when I was with them. They suddenly realized what we're doing and says, well, let's invent something like it. They called it IMPACT, 20-year law held. So that's about the way they have. I guess it's those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
So all of those, manprint, hard man, IMPACT, they're all efforts to look at problems from a systems standpoint, mm-hmm. looking at manpower, personnel, hardware, software, communication, the many aspects that can affect system performance. And like others of your generation, David Meister comes to mind, you've always emphasized a system approach to problem solving or performance improvement. For instance, you were instrumental, as you said, in the concept of manprint for the Army. Tell us briefly about the systems approach and your assessment whether or not we remain true to it.
To me, the best description of a system goes all the way back to 1600, and a philosopher called Blaise Pascal. And he said at one time, I find it impossible to know the parts without knowing the whole, as to know the whole without specifically knowing the parts. And what he's really talking about is that in our business, many times, we find ourselves looking at the things, the little bitty things. Like in some of the sessions I've been in today, people fail to step back and take a look at the big picture. And that's what a system is. A system is a configuration of components, usually made up of people and devices, put together to satisfy some goal. Many times people forget, if you don't know what the goal is, you don't know how to design to it. So I try to be a preacher to this. I teach, when I teach my class at Maryland, I drum this into the student's head as best I can. But it really means that when you're going to do a piece of research, I would like people to step back and think of it in terms of the big picture. What I do now, what will be the implications for this total system that it'll be used in?
You know, in some settings, particularly engineering settings, the human factors person might be viewed as an outsider, sometimes even as an obstacle rather than an aid to the development process. What's the best way for a human factors specialist to better integrate himself or herself into an engineering team or some other team?
Yeah, I'd have to go back to something I said before when, with our first experience on going up to the hill with Smoke Price and me and Dean Havrin. We were like Mr. Smith goes to Washington. We were unnerved by the whole experience. We went in to see the staffers, and you got to understand, staffers are the ones that do the work. So you got to get through them before you ever get to the congressman or the senator. The staffer gave us some of the best advice we ever had in a concise and precise way. What he said was, he said, first off, you people write, you can't clear your throat in less than 2 pages. And he said, everybody in Congress, just about everybody, is a lawyer. And lawyers like legal briefs. So when you come to tell us something, tell us in 1 page. And don't caveat it. If you're telling us the truth, we'll accept it. If you don't tell us the truth or you're wrong, you'll never get in the door again. But he said we need it precise and concise. It's that simple. So we said, okay. We went to the members of the society, sent out a bunch of letters and notes, said, give us some critical incidents, some things that you've worked on that made sense that we can use. We got probably 80 or so reports, none of which were readable by any lawyer. By us, as human factors types, they look great. Smoke and I and Dean tried to edit it down to 1-pagers. And eventually did, and that's where Smoke came up with the thing about the money saving on the aircraft carrier. Somewhere in my basement, musty place, I may have a copy of the report we put together with those 25 or 30 illustrative studies that made a difference. So, what we really need are short, precise, concise things for engineers to use, be able to put them in their pocket. What happens with the engineers I've talked to, they say, I ask you what time it is, and you begin by describing in detail how to build the clock. So don't need that. So keep it precise, keep it concise, answer the question, answer the problem, and don't BS them.
You know, in the late 70s, when I first joined the society, I was very pleased to learn that the human factors graybeards were always accepting, open, and helpful to the junior personnel. I'm thinking of yourself, of Julian Christensen, of Harold Van Cott, Donald Topmiller, folks who were very willing to help mentor others along the line. Even as the society was growing hand over fist in size, they always had time. How can we assure that this continues someday upon the changing of the guard?
Now, one thing, I think something like this, get some of the graybeards in, have them explain for a more general audience. I mean, mentoring one-on-one is great. You should do that as much as you can for the people you work with, your students, whatever. But in a larger sense, what they got to do is catch some of this, let the rest of the people know. And this would be one good way to do that. There are not enough good examples, I don't think, in the literature. Maybe the human factors people ought to go back and put a lessons learned book together. And lessons learned is used now, for example, in the Army all the time, in a lot of industry. And I've never seen a symposium at the Human Factors Society meetings called Lessons Learned, where you go in and talk about how it started, what went wrong, and what had to be done to correct it. Mm-hmm. Then the people that are coming into the business, who, if they're smart, will say, my God, I don't want to make that mistake.
Well, along the same lines, can you tell us a success story, one in which the human factors personnel made an outstanding contribution to the success of an important project?
Yeah. Can think of maybe a couple. If you go back and think way back and go back to World War II, the general principle used in psychology of mass versus distributed learning came out of an application on teaching people Morse code. Consider also that here we put thousands of bombers in the air that were manned, flown, and maintained by country boys, farmers, and the like. And we managed to design for a general population to teach them how to do that. There was a friend of mine, Stan Deutsch, who was a senior person in NASA at one time, who told me that not a single one of those early missions, manned missions, would have ever made it safely if it hadn't been for the capability for humans to override. Yeah. They have been trained to it and helped in the design proper. The other one that comes to mind is the one that I worked on, which was the SAGE system. It was the first interactive digital system, huge system, never been one as big built in the world. It was the air defense system for the entire United States. And if you can think of some others, like Three Mile Island, if they don't learn from that and they're starting to start new nuclear plants, if they haven't got that lesson learned, they ought to.
You know, of all the changes within the human factors discipline over the years, which changes stand out as significant, or challenges, excuse me, which ones stand out as significant challenges for the future?
One I can tell you immediately, and it's finally coming to the fore, is the aging population and the usability design. And it's projected by about 1930, by 2050, that there will be about 25%, actually it's really earlier, it's 2030, there'll be about 25% of the population will be over age 65. They're also the biggest consumers, but consumer designers don't take that into account. And I sort of merely cite to you the bad, terrible bad design of cell phones. And only one cell phone I know of, called the Jitterbug, has ever been designed for the older population. The second one is that way back when I was doing work in artificial intelligence, the only way you could do it was to have access to a very big, powerful computer. AI programs we had then were terrible hogs of time, of space. There was an individual who may still be there at the Palo Alto Research Center called John Seely Brown, who wrote the only book I knew of applying artificial intelligence to computer-based training. Now that we have the powerful technology, we go back and remine that thing, get the nuggets out of that, and advance our training techniques by adding AI. And the models for that I would say about pulling all the human factors disciplines together are the things that we really need, like Senge's fifth discipline approach. Art Sigal and Jeb Wolf wrote a book once on human performance modeling, And since we've had a few models that address this, I don't know of a model, I may be wrong, that takes a look at a complete system, plugs what we know about people in them, and sees what happens to the system output, not the output of the device, when people perform in that. So larger scale human system modeling, AI applied to CAI, and don't forget the gray panthers. They're, if you forget about them, they'll remind you.
Well, you started this work in the 50s, and now in 2007, you're still working. You're teaching, you're passing on the wisdom you've learned to those with less experience. In retrospect, could there have been a better profession for Jim Baker?
And let's see. When I started out, Harry Harlow advocated. My goal was to be replace Harry Harlow as the greatest comparative psychologist in the world. To me, he was still the greatest psychologist, not to me. But I found out that animals bite, so I decided I'd do something different. So when I got into graduate school, I said, oh, I'll become a clinician. And I tried my hand at that. I had the best, Julian Roeder. I took classes from him and all, and I found out that clinical was not for me. But in the meantime, I had the good fortune to get involved on a project in the Aviation Research Lab for Paul Fitts at Ohio State, and I said, ah, there's my niche. And that's when I got into this thing, found my calling. Engineering psychology is my love of my life. Systems in particular, I look at the entire world as a giant system and try to do whatever my bigger thing is to make it a better place to live. So at any rate, nah, what I do now is my best calling. But I'll tell you, Pete, if I ever figure out what I want to be when I grow up, I'll let you know.
When were you born?
When was I born? December 7th, 1928. December 7th. Do you know what date that is?
Is that D-Day? No.
No.
I don't know.
The day will live in infamy. It's Pearl Harbor.
Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up? In Philadelphia. Do you know Philadelphia?
Not really, but what was it like growing up in Philadelphia?
Well, I grew up during the Depression years, and one of the things I found was that I look back on it, growing up in the Depression years, there was no such thing as a kid having money to buy something. And we were talking the other evening, Pete and I, and I realized that, for example, to play ball, to learn how to play baseball, and take an old broom, cut the handle off, take a ball, cut it in half, and you can throw curves and everything on it. And on the street, called street ball, you could, we didn't have little leagues where adults who couldn't play ball at any rate tried to tell kids how to play ball and boss them around and play. We made our own teams. We made our own rules. We learned what it took to do that. We did a lot of doing without, but it caused us to have to think our way through things. Did they turn out okay? Well, I don't know whether it's a true statement, but what they talk about, the greatest generation, they're the ones that came out of that kind of depression era.
Do you think that because you were little and you had to really create your own fun out of very little, that that's what led you into wanting to be a problem solver?
Hadn't thought of it that way. Probably is, because one of the things, maybe not as a problem solver, but I'll tell you what I think is interesting that's missing today. When I was a kid growing up, my brother and I snuck a radio up into our bedroom, and very quietly and under the bed we'd play it, and they'd have things like The Shadow Knows or I Love a Mystery or something like that that would scare the bejesus out of us. And the point is that there is no television. There was no television then. You had to, in your own mind's eye, visualize all that. You had to just see the picture yourself. And what I find now is that if you sit at a television set, they've already prescribed what the world is. You can't, I don't know how we're going to get creativity cranked in here, because if you're always there hypnotized, they tell you what to see, what to hear, what to believe, then how are you ever going to think on your own? So rather than a problem solver, I think what it helped me do is, you know, I mentioned systems are the thing I love to deal with most. It allows me to step back and think, where do all the pieces fit? What does the picture look like in my head? If I put it together, it may not be perfect, but it comes pretty close.
That's an interesting observation. I've heard kindergarten teachers tell me that they have a very difficult time with kindergarten first graders running them into imagination exercises. The kids just have difficulty imagining things because everything is, all the ideas and images are force-fed.
Mm-hmm. And I think one other item is that as kids, hopefully, I guess it was a little different time than I'm sure it was, but from the first thing in the morning, the only warning you got was go outside and make sure you're back here when your father comes home from work, that's all, for dinner. So you got to go out and do your own thing, ride bikes, explore the world, find places, you know. It may be a block away, but it was a whole new world. And one of the, you know, you explore and all, but it also kept you in good physical shape. And that's why if you go watch, for example, this Ken Burns special, you won't find, because they were on food rationing and all, you don't find people that were out of shape. There were a lot of people had to walk. There was no gasoline, very little. No new cars were built from 1942 until 1946. Maybe 120 cars that were sedans for the military. So people couldn't drive cars. Gas rations, I don't know what an A stamp was, maybe 12 gallons a week. Can you imagine driving everywhere in 12 gallons a week now? So everybody was a lot more fit. Now, one of the things that bothers me, I watch with some members of my own family, for example, kids stay in the house, they come in from school and they play these electronic games. And there's not much perceptual activity, but there sure isn't any physical activity. So it doesn't surprise me now that since the world has changed to a degree, I don't mean to become an old fogey in that sense, but maybe some of the stuff we ought to back into. Push the kids out the door, take the electronic game away at least an hour, and tell them, look at that beautiful sun, that breeze, get out there and try it. That's the world. That whole world belongs to you. Go explore it. You mean like sport?
Just any kind of games that you used to play with. You mentioned you had a brother.
Oh, well, I have a brother.
Oh, did you say you had a brother?
Oh, I had, three brothers. Yeah. I was the oldest of six kids in the family. What was it like growing up? I'll tell you, do I have time? Tell you a little tale. With brothers, when you're growing up, it's amazing. If your brother's 4 years younger than you, and you're 8 or 9, that's a world of difference. If you're 65 and they're 61, it's amazing you're the same age. But at that time, I used to go out, and there was a fear as a kid growing up, your mother would tell you, every mother would, don't you go swimming because you'll catch infantile paralysis, polio. In my neighborhood, there were kids there in the kind of braces and all that, which FDR had. It was a very bad disease, and science and technology has saved us from that. Well, a mother can tell you not to do that. Whether you do it or not is something different. So my gang and I used to take off, and there was a crummy old stream near us. We'd go there and swim. My brother said, I want to go along too. I said, no. He said, then I'm going to tell Mom. I said, hop on the bike. I'll take you with me. And we went down to this grungy old stream in the city like that, and we had put a rope up, and we'd swing and drop in the water. My brother's on the other bank, and we didn't tell him. All of us knew. At 5 o'clock, you would hear, was the whistle, and upstream from there was this big textile plant, and they would dump all the dye out there, and the dye had come down, so we knew when you heard it be out of the water. I look, it's like a Tarzan picture. My brother's on the other side of the stream. It's like the alligators had come, and we're all yelling, Bill, Bill, come on, come on. He's what, swim, swim. He's swimming like crazy. We all grab him. Too late. My brother's legs from about the thigh down were blue, a very beautiful royal blue. Further, we used to swim without benefit of trunks. And we were pretty well tanned. He wasn't. And so he had this white butt, kind of tan top, blue, legs red. So we take him home. And my mother takes one look at there's that son, sunburned red with a white butt and blue legs. Looked to me very patriotic, but not to my mother. And she gave me the classic warning, wait till your father comes home. And she was right. It was like somebody saying, don't board the Titanic. But that's what it was like growing up.
What happened when your father got home?
We don't want to hear about brutality on this tape. Now, he wasn't brutal, but I'll tell you, he was hard. Oof.
So did your brother's legs, did they eventually, how long did it take for them to
get
back to their regular
Yeah, body? My father had the perfect answer. Took him in the basement with turpentine, which even made it worse. Got the bulk of it out, and over the summer, the blue legs disappeared. But I always thought he looked pretty neat. Yeah, they were fun. So you see, even though the times may have been hard, they were fun times. Do you want another brother story or something?
Sure, you have time.
I got time? Yeah. Oh, God. All right. My brother Bill, again. When we were kids, a big family, six kids, you all shared bedrooms kind of things. And, in fact, even in the same bed and whatever. So we had this big old metal bed. It had, like, pipes across the bottom and at the bottom and the top. And it was like corrugated metal in between. If you ever saw an old-fashioned metal bed like that. And we would jump on it. My father go insane if he heard us down there. Well, Bill and I had come from seeing a movie, the Saturday matinee. You could get in for a dime. One person go in, the other one quickly open a fire exit and sneak others in. So at any rate, we get in there, and we'd seen a Tarzan movie. And Tarzan would go, oh, and leap and grab these vines and swing. So we're laying on bed, and my brother said, he said, that's amazing. He said that Huck Tarzan can do that. So I said, Bill, I can do that. Baloney, he said. I said, baloney yourself. He said, prove it. So I climb up on the end of the bed, like that bedstead. And the room wasn't that big, and there was a door, the bedroom door there. So I give the Tarzan yell, leap, and catch that door. Which I had forgotten about the simple laws of physics. If you throw all that weight against an open door, it's going to close. And if it's going to close, it's going to close on your fingers. And it's going to bend all your fingernails back. And if you can't let go, you can holler like crazy to your father, opens the door, says, what's that? And you drop to the floor in abject pain. Only to find out you're going to be punished for doing something as stupid as that. But I proved to him, Tarzan can do it, and so can I.
Your trips up to the river to go swimming remind me of something. Even in the what would it be, 1970 era, something like that. I had a 59 MG, and we would go north of Baltimore up to the Gunpowder River. There was a spot you could go up next to the railroad tracks. They had removed one set of tracks, and you could drive your car up along the stone and came to a place where the tree was big enough for a swing. And we would swim there and have fun, do things. You might even find a few empty beer bottles there when we were gone. And one day, I swapped my car for David's 55 Chevy. And with my friend Tom, we went up, went for a swim, got bored, said, let's explore a little further up the track. So we did. We found a spot where there was a cliff where people used to take their old cars and push them off the cliff. The newest one we could find was a 53 Chevy, so that was about 17 years old. We could get up to the top of this cliff through kind of a sandy hill, rather steep. And we thought we'd drive up there, but we didn't think it was wise to throw David's car off the cliff. But Tom saw a 55-gallon drum over there, said, let's take that up there and throw it off the cliff. Fine. So we put that in the back of the trunk of the car. The trunk wouldn't close, of course. And we started up the hill. Well, we got about halfway. Given the poor traction, the wheel started spinning. The car started to go backwards, which, of course, let the trunk go open, and the drum rolled out of the trunk. Then the car rolled over the trunk, the drum, in a manner that it was underneath the differential. So here on the steep hill, the car was level. The wheel, back wheels are about 2 feet off the ground.
Spinning.
On a good August day, 95 degrees, 95% humidity, and there we were stuck. So we had to figure out what to do. I said, Tom, this was your idea. We got to figure a way out of here. And in the trunk of David's car, we found a little 5-pound ball, and I gave it to Tom, said, start at it. He crawled underneath and started beating that drum until it got flat enough we could pull it out and back down the road. But it's something, referring to something earlier you said. You know, we used to go out and through the trees and make trails, have tree forts, acorn battles, those kinds of things. Now, with the electronic devices and with the concerns 20 years ago about kids being stolen, the kids just don't go out. The woods are overgrown. There's no trails. Can't find a tree house.
Right.
That kind of fun just doesn't seem to be in the picture anymore. But it's a great opportunity that we had to go out and explore when the world was safe enough.
Yeah. Two more minutes. I'll tell you one other thing. I go back, and what do you learn as a kid like that in that era? Like Pete was saying, when you go out and you explore, in our case, we did most of our exploring on a bike. I mean, that was the greatest thing of freedom, you know, that you could imagine. If you ever got that bike for Christmas, you know, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. You could go all over the world, your world. But the other thing it taught us was that if you got to keep it running, you would do something like, I had a box on it with an old rag around it, then it had included an adjustable end wrench and a screwdriver I borrowed from my father. And it meant that you had to maintain that. I used to have to take it apart. If the bearings wore out, I had to walk clear to Pep Boys with my money, whatever I'd have, buy a bearing, put it in, keep that thing running. You learn to do or you do without. And one of the things you learned was, very quickly, little mechanical skills, like how to keep doggone things running. Today, where you live in a throwaway culture, they would have taken that bike and taken it to the dump. But we couldn't, and learned how to keep things running.
We had a similar trip once when we lived in the northern part of Baltimore. My father worked as a psychologist at the state penitentiary. And one of the neighborhood troublemakers said, hey, let's take a nice bike ride. We had 10 kids, actually 11 kids, 10 bikes. He was the one without a bike. Since I was the smallest, he threw me up on the handlebars of my own bike. And we left from the northern part of Baltimore and went and found the railroad tracks and rode all the way down the railroad tracks through the tunnels with the trains and on down to the state penitentiary. And I forget how many miles it was. Didn't realize at the time it was downhill till we turned around and started north again. But we had the freedom to do that. Of course, that was a 3 weeks worth of grounding when we got back. But still, it was a great experience. Good.
One more minute. All right, I'll tell you one more thing. Pete mentioned going to the penitentiary thing. in Philly, I played on a Sandlot neighborhood football team. It was in what was called the Pop Warner League. We had a player coach named Jim Kelly, and he booked all the games for us all over the city. Certain things, like us from North Philly, you didn't want to be playing in South Philly unless you had an exit strategy before you got there. But he, in his infinite wisdom, booked us a game with the Holmesburg Prison Trustee Team. And we didn't know till we got there to play on this really grungy field. And we came into the first huddle, and my buddy Dave Dixon, I was the center, he was the guard. He said, "Gee, that guy took his helmet off." He said, wiped the sweat. "He's older than my old man. What am I going to do?" I said, "Treat him nice." Whatever. It was fun.